welcome to the War Studies podcast. We bring you world-leading research from the School of Security Studies at King's College London, the largest community of scholars in the world dedicated to the study of all aspects of security, defence and international relations. We aim to explore the complex realm of conflict because the study of war is fundamental to understanding the world we live in and the world we want to live in.
It's just about a more mature, reasonable assessment, which we can probably make now after 100 years. We can begin to look at the First World War with something approaching dispassion. It is important that we move on from it. And I think the memory of the individuals of the war demands that we have a more accurate assessment.
In today's episode, we speak to Professor Nick Lloyd about his book, The Western Front, A History of the First World War, in which he counters the prevailing myth that the generals were useless, unfeeling aristocrats, unable to adapt to the nature of modern warfare. In so doing, he provides a much more complex and nuanced understanding of these men trying to cope with a war that had shattered their lives as much as any other.
The Western Front, that cauldron of war, a bubbling, fermenting experiment in killing that changed the world, the Western Front would become synonymous with stalemate and mass slaughter, with indecisive, attritional struggles amid a tortured landscape of barbed wire and mud. It would also inspire some of the most important works of literature of the 20th century. In Britain, at least, the legend of the Western Front has become deeply embedded within the social fabric. Of the 764,000 British Great War dead, almost 85% were lost in France and Belgium. This enormous sacrifice, far greater than any previous or subsequent conflict, has never been forgotten and has formed the main component of a story of futility and folly that continues to influence social attitudes towards the war to this day. On the Western Front, the onset of trench warfare in the autumn of 1914 meant that the Allied powers of Britain and France had little choice but to attack. So they mounted a series of major offensives, each bigger than the last, to break up the trench network and return to mobile warfare in the hope that once it had been restarted, Germany could be defeated and France liberated. Into each offensive, they poured their manpower and deployed their technology in ever-increasing amounts, only to see their efforts thwarted and the blood cost rise ever higher. In response, Germany dug deeper trenches, widened and expanded her defensive networks into ever more labyrinthine fortifications, and counterattacked whenever possible. It was only in 1918 that maturing weapon systems, new tactics, and fresh manpower allowed the front to be broken, maneuver restored, and a decision finally reached. All the commanders struggled in this maelstrom, trying to cope with a war that had shattered their lives as much as any other. They were not, as is so often portrayed today, unapproachable men of iron, devoid of humanity or warmth. They were human beings with families, some of whom would be terribly damaged by the battles they themselves directed. Generals were not even safe themselves. Contrary to the myth of the Chateau General, hundreds of general officers would be killed or wounded during the war, shot by snipers, caught by shellfire, or succumbing to disease and ill health brought on by the effects of ceaseless campaigning. Few European families were untouched by the Great War, and its commanders were no different. For years, these men have been characterized as donkeys or butchers, unfeeling military aristocrats fighting the wrong kind of war, unable to adapt or change to the new realities unfolding on the battlefield. The truth was a much messier picture of trial and error, success and failure, with each promising development followed by an equally effective countermeasure.
Welcome to the War Studies podcast. Our guest today is Professor Nick Lloyd, Professor of Modern Warfare in the Defence Studies Department at King's. He has published widely on military and imperial history in the era of the Great War and has written five books, including the best-selling Passchendaele, A New History, which was chosen as one of the Telegraph's 50 best books of 2017. But today's podcast will focus on his latest book, The Western Front, which was published last year and featured on a best reads list by The Times. It is part of a major three-volume narrative history of the First World War, with the next volumes concentrating on the Eastern Front, followed by the war in Africa and the Middle East. The aim behind Professor Lloyd's three-part volume, including the Western Front, is to write a narrative history of the First World War, to tell the story as closely as possible, without too much abstract theorizing or lengthy commentaries on different interpretations. Instead, in his own words, He has tried to bring readers closer in so that they might see the war, sit beside the main characters, and form their own judgment. In this way, it has been written primarily through the lens of senior commanders who fought the war, at what modern militaries refer to as the operational level, i.e. how the generals faced with the reality of modern warfare in all its horror and complexity, tried to deal with it, and how they succeeded or more likely failed. So Nick, welcome to the podcast. As you argue in the introduction to your book, one of the prevailing myths about the First World War that remains very much a key part of how we understand the war is the lions led by donkeys idea, that the brave soldiers, the lions fighting in the trenches, were sent to their deaths by incompetent and indifferent leaders, the donkeys, who didn't really know what they were doing and believed a war of attrition was the only way out. So to get us started, how did this myth come about and why has it been such a powerful metaphor in popular consciousness since the war ended?
Yeah, I think it's something you come to very quickly when you look at the First World War. It's almost the first thing you realise about the war. You have this myth and the chateau generals, the donkeys. It's such a, certainly in Britain, it's such a powerful popular memory. It's become a cliche, really. You only have to sort of realise the sort of long-lasting success of Blackadder Goes Forth to see how deep and how hard that grip on popular culture is with the war. So it was certainly the way I approached the war when I first looked at it. It was a truth. That was obviously the case. The generals were clearly stupid and that was it. And of course, when you look into it, when you read more about the war, when you begin to understand it, the true complexity and horror and difficulty of what the generals were up against becomes apparent. And I think writing about the military history of the war is something you have to tackle head on, really. So it's really important that we revise that, or we at least try to make it more complex in a way than it sometimes seems.
Thank you. And where did that quote come from originally?
It's quoted in Alan Clark's book, The Donkeys, which was published in 1963, I think. And of course, Alan Clark was controversial in his day, and he wrote, I think, quite a good book. It's written very vibrantly. It's an easy read about the British in 1914 and 15 and the donkeys. And of course, there's lots of problems with the book, but it's one of those books that becomes really important. And he has the quote at the start of the book. It's supposed to be by General Hoffman, who's a German officer, who's talking about this. And you have this quote, well, you know, the British lions led by donkeys. And the quote is, of course, on reference. And when Alan Clark was questioned about it, he couldn't really answer. And so the rumor is that this is essentially just made up. It has other earlier indications in military history. You can find it in the 1870 Franco-Prussian War. You can get a quote about it. You can find it earlier. And so it's just something that people sometimes say about generals, but it's become particularly associated with the British generals in the First World War, predominantly through Alan Clark's book.
Efforts to debunk this myth have been made across the decades since the 1960s. So why did you decide to tackle this now? And how do you think your approach differs from attempts of the past?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's always been that double history of the war between those who've taken the popular understanding and those who've challenged it. And you can go all the way back to the 1930s. John Terrain's book, Douglas Haig, The Educated Soldier, in 1960s, was, of course, a direct challenge to the Clarkian popular myth, if you will. And so there's always been those people who've revised it, who've challenged it. Predominantly, this has been a British debate. So we've talked a lot about British generals. And what I do is widen it out to both the German generals and the French generals. What I've tried to do is present a more coherent, complex story of the challenges that all the generals faced across the Western Front on both sides of the line. So you begin to appreciate, I think, some of the challenges they face. But I think, you know, there were poor commanders in the war. There were very mediocre commanders in the war. There were some exceptional commanders in the war. The truth is it's a bit of a mixture. So I think sometimes the revisionists and the people who challenge popular memory can sometimes go the other way, and all the generals were brilliant. And of course, the reality is a mixture, as I suppose it is in most wars. You know, most people are average and mediocre, and there are a few that get it very quickly, and there are a few that are utterly hopeless. The problem is, in the First World War, is if you make mistakes, then it gets very bloody very, very quickly. And what I've tried to do is present it in a more coherent context so you can see all of the main commanders and what they try to do, and in some ways make your own judgment on them.
And coming on to this, you know, you obviously talk about bringing in the different perspectives from different countries, so Germany as well as France, Britain and the United States. Can you talk a bit more about this approach and also how the style of the generals differed between the countries? For example, does the Lions Led by Donkey Smith also exist in other countries like France and Germany, or do they see things in a slightly different light?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I think we tend to see it obviously very much from a British perspective. And there isn't really a Lions Led by Donkey's Myth in other countries. You know, Germany, for example, has a very complex memory of the First World War, but it has been largely, you know, overshadowed clearly by the Second World War and the memory of the Holocaust. So the First World War doesn't really get the attention it perhaps deserves. And there are some generals that are infamous in the war, Hindenburg and Ludendorff particularly. But the large swathes of those, you know, general officers are largely unknown or simply not really written about. France as well is a complex myth and a complex idea. I think there have been criticism of their generals over the years. There's also been a growing number of people who've made out the kind of more positive story about some of their generals. But even one of their great heroes of the war, Philippe Pétain, of course, his memory is very much clouded by his experience in the Second World War. So that muddies the waters very much. I think for Britain, one of the reasons why we get the Lions and Donkeys is this is really our first experience of war on this scale. And the shock is so great and the losses are so great that it's almost unimaginable to Britain to experience something like this. And so, of course, there is a natural desire to want to explain why this happened. And in some ways, it's much easier to blame the people involved than look at, you know, the reality of what they're up against and the complexity of making war in the 20th century and the dangers and how bloody and brutal it is. And of course, in America, the First World War isn't really remembered in the same way. Again, you have domination of the Second World War. And the few generals that are known, General Pershing, General Hunter Liggett, there's really only a handful that actually know about these individuals. So it hasn't really had the same salience as it has in Britain.
So yeah, so your book is obviously shedding light on these generals from other countries and exploring what they were doing and their role in a way that hasn't been done so much before. So if we come on to that, can you talk us through some of the generals that you focus on, what sort of techniques they were using, what their styles of command were, what decisions they were making, and how you felt about them as well?
The book obviously goes through the opening battles of Maneuver. And then as the war evolves and you get into the trench warfare period, we then go through that middle period of the war, which for most people is the war. The war, of course, is bookended by two periods of maneuver, which ironically enough are the bloodiest periods. Casualties per day is worse in battles of maneuver than it is in trench warfare. Most people assume trench warfare is uniquely bloody, but it's actually not. And so we trace the battles of maneuver and you get, you know, there's some standout characters in the book. You've got General von Moltke, the German chief of staff, has a nervous breakdown within a couple of weeks. He is replaced by Erich von Falkenhayn, who's much colder, much more stable, pessimistic about Germany and the way he fights his war in a more attritional sense. And of course, with the German command team, you have a constant pressure on whether they need to fight in the West or the East. And so they're kind of trying to manage resources. And the commanders in the East team of Hindenburg and Ludendorff become a real thorn in Falkenhayn's side until eventually Falkenhayn is dismissed. Hindenburg and Ludendorff take over in the West. There are fewer key German generals than there are on the Allied side because power is much more concentrated in Germany in the military elite. So you have people like Falkenhayn and then you have Hindenburg and Ludendorff, and they are really the key players. I think some of the German generals sometimes can be difficult to get a sense of warmth out of them because sometimes it can feel a little bit cold. Certainly found that with Hindenburg and Ludendorff. They are quite difficult to gain a real insight into. Very military figures. They have a very, almost a closed world. The world is entirely military. And so Ludendorff hates politicians. He doesn't really see anything other from a military perspective. Falkenhayn as well is quite a cold individual. He is focused on attrition. He wants to kill Frenchmen. And so in a sense, they're not really likable characters in that sense. I became more respectful of Falkenhayn, who leads the German army in the first 2 years of the war, because he seemed to have more of an idea about what the war was really about and how it would be fought and what you needed to do to win. And so he is very much aware of the need to balance resources across the fronts and the need to bleed your opponent. And so he has, I think, a better idea of the limitations of German power and also what they might want to do. I think Hindenburg and Ludendorff have a much more closed mind. It's all about battlefield success. It's all about maneuver. And so that ultimately fails. If we look at the French army, there's a lot of French generals in the book. I mean, predominantly have General Joffre, who commands the French army through the opening battles until the end of 1916. And Joffre is quite an interesting figure because he doesn't really look like a soldier. He's quite, should we say, rotund. He always gets a good night's sleep and he never misses a meal. And you find a great portrait of Joffre in Barbara Tuchman's Guns of August. So Joffre is a sort of genial chap who doesn't really seem particularly intellectual or clever, but I think he has a certain gravitas and a certain coherency within himself, which means he's very good. So whereas General von Moltke, who's the first chief of staff for Germany, simply breaks down, I can't stand it, and has to be essentially removed from office very quickly. Joffre just keeps going. He keeps fighting. He picks himself back up again when things go wrong, and he keeps going and ultimately saves France from defeat. So Joffre, I think, is a character that is one of the great generals of the war. You know, the personality of Joffre is very important, I think. The way he can just absorb punishment and keep fighting. Ultimately, he can't really then win the war in the following 2 years because France just can't do it. And so ultimately, he's disappointed, I think, at the end because he just sort of runs out of steam and he's not really sure how they can fight. And ultimately, he's replaced by Second General Nivelle and then by Philippe Pétain. Pétain is a very interesting character because, you know, he's quite old at the start of the war, so he's not risen as far as he would have liked. And he's very different from Joffre. He's a much colder individual. He's much more sober, pessimistic about life in general, about the war. And that pessimism allows him to see how they might do things differently in the West. And he's very much an attritional general and he wants to fight in a way that saves the French army as much as possible. And I think there's very little chance the French army survives the war, particularly 1916, 1917, without Pétain's realism about what they can actually achieve on the battlefield. And he gets rid of a lot of nonsense. They talked about breakthrough. He says, no, we can't do it. We need to wait for the tanks and the Americans. And so Pétain has a very important role. And I think there's no doubt that he's a great commander in the war. He hasn't risen as far as he would have liked prior to the war because he doesn't say what the generals and what the popular conventional wisdom is. He scorns the idea of big maneuvers and everything like that. And he thinks it's all about firepower. And ultimately, he's right. Where Pétain slightly goes wrong is he can't then adapt to the changing circumstances you have in 1918, where the German army is being ground down, is falling to pieces, but Pétain retains a certain, you know, they're still going to fight on, and ultimately they can't. So Pétain is ultimately found out. There are other commanders I like in the French army, obviously Ferdinand Foch, who becomes the generalissimo, the commander-in-chief in 1918. And Foch is, I think, quite a warm character. He's one of the characters I think you could quite like. One of the staff officers who worked with both Foch and Pétain was asked to describe them, and he drew a little picture, and it was a straight line for Pétain. Pétain is always the same. Doesn't matter what you do, he's always the same, just a straight line. And when he was asked to describe Foch, he described a line going up, then down, then up, then down, then up, then down, because he's constant, much more energetic. Foch is a man who ultimately fights the war in 1918 and wins the war for the Allies because he's able to be aggressive and move on the front foot when the situation changes. And I think that's his great gift and his great strength. I think Foch is a great general that has not had the attention or the praise that he deserves for leading that coalition to victory in 1918. You know, there are other British generals, obviously Sir Douglas Haig, and on the British side is a man who is probably the most controversial commander of the war. Haig, I think, is not a great commander, but he's not a donkey. He has certain strengths and certain weaknesses. I think he's very much limited in some ways. He's good at certain things. He's good at administration, bureaucracy, some of the, I don't want to say boring, but certainly unfashionable aspects of military command he's very good at. He's less good at the actual operational tactical stuff. There are other British commanders I think do very well. Henry Rawlinson, Sir Herbert Plumer that I describe in the book, that I found excellent battlefield soldiers. And so again, there's a mixed bag. I think certain commanders are just unlucky. They just go in at the wrong time. They just happen to fight the wrong enemy at the wrong time and they get sacked and everything. I think one of the benefits of doing my approach when I cover the whole war is you can see rise and fall of individuals. So you see individuals that come from nowhere and rise up and get promoted and then sometimes fail badly, and other people kind of come back and get sacked and then come back. And so you can see the sort of rise and fall in that I think is particularly useful because it's not just about one battle. It's about a whole campaign.
Yeah, because you sort of talk about Kitchener in that respect, I think, as well, because, you know, we associate Kitchener very much with the start of the First World War, that famous poster everybody remembers. But then he sort of falls away, and you sort of talk about what happens with his career, I guess, how that tails off.
Yeah, you find certainly a lot of the commanders really struggle when it moves to trench warfare, because it's not the war they're expecting and they're not sure how this fits in with warfare, because we've been trained on maneuver and decisive battle like Waterloo, really, and have a 2 or 3 day engagement, you maneuver. So what is trench warfare? How do we approach it? Do we approach it like normal battle, or is it something differently? And so Kitchener is really puzzled by this. And, you know, he doesn't really know what they should do other than just sort of try to mass firepower, mass infantry and everything. And it takes a kind of different approach to really break the trench deadlock in late 1917, 1918. You do get, you know, a lot of commanders are really puzzled by it. Joffre is puzzled by it. And they try to adapt what they know. And I think what you also see from the book is that as the Allies begin to practice and test tactics and new strategies to, you know, break the trench deadlock, you then see the other side of the hill where the Germans then say, okay, that was pretty good. I didn't really like what the Allies were doing. So we need to do this. We need to do that. And so you see this constant process of innovation on both sides where they learn. And so the Allies break the front trench, then the Germans simply build a second line. And then they broke the second line, they build a third line. And then the Allies' artillery begins to get much more effective. Therefore, the German defensive zone would get bigger and stronger. And so the generals are having to sort of almost take two steps forward in order to actually have an effect on the battlefield. And this problem is a real issue as they begin to start to grapple with the reality of trench warfare and the demands that it makes on their men and the technology they're going to need, the ammunition they're going to need.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting that you sort of, because I guess we presume that, you know, trench warfare is synonymous with, you know, stasis and just trying the same thing over and over and over again. And yet you were talking there about how they were innovating, trying out new things. And you talk in your book about the technologies. And again, part of the line said, like, Donkey's myth is that the generals were reluctant to use new technologies. They preferred old-fashioned techniques and were suspicious about new technology. So can you talk a little bit about how they tried to innovate?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the great myths of the war that the generals are sort of traditionalist and they don't want to use technology. I think you see the amount of technological development, particularly on the Western Front. I mean, there's technological development across the war, but it's really sharpened in France and Belgium, I think. So you've got the use of air power. The generals may initially be quite skeptical, but as soon as the trench warfare sets in, they recognize the importance of aerial reconnaissance and keeping control of the air and denying that to the enemy. And then as the aircraft become more capable, they then start, okay, can we do something else? Can we bomb trenches? Can we do close air support or interdiction? Can we? So air power is an entire story on its own of innovation that both sides, you know, innovate in many, many ways and incorporate all of that into their plans. For example, the British used tanks as one of the big headlines of the war. They developed tanks in about 18 months from a standing start. They use gas, they use enormous amounts of artillery and very sophisticated artillery. So it's not just mass. You know, by 1918, they've got very, very sophisticated use of gas, smoke, different types of artillery, extremely good fuses, much heavier artillery. And so it's all coordinated into very complex fire plans. But even earlier in the war, they were trying to do things and they recognized that artillery particularly is going to be the big weapon, but they don't have enough of it and they don't have enough shells. And so they can't really innovate when they don't have the equipment. So, for example, in the 35-minute bombardment that the British do prior to the Battle of Neuve-Chapelle in March 1915, they fire off more shells than they did in the entire South African war just a decade earlier. So what they're doing is incredible. They never would have had to fire that many shells in such a complex bombardment before. But even that's not enough. And if, you know, the following year, they've got 7-day bombardments, they fire a million shells. So it's both mass and also complexity. Poison gas is a story of all its own, how that's used. Machine guns, mortars, rifle grenades, steel helmets. So the technological side of the war is remarkable. How quickly they develop and how quickly modern warfare comes about. And if you look at 1918, some of the things the Allies are doing are really impressive in terms of deception with the use of spoofing wireless signals to throw the Germans off the scent. They're doing extremely complex things with coordination between air power and tanks, you know, really good air-land integration that will become known as small unit tactics, infiltration tactics, dropping supplies to forward infantry from the air. I mean, this is all modern stuff. And again, this is in 4 years that they've essentially gone from a standing start to, you know, modern warfare pretty much. So the story of technology in the war is, I think, disproves really clearly the donkey's myth. We can argue about whether they could have slightly used them better or whether they should have incorporated them earlier, but this is about degrees. In many cases, Haig, Douglas Haig, who again is very controversial, known as a general who was very traditional, was very pro-technology. And he put people in charge who were very good at it. You know, Haig is very interested in using gas. He's very interested in using the tank. He's very pro air power. He might not understand this technology, but he's certainly not in any way hindering its development. And I think that's a real myth of the war.
That's really interesting and quite shocking, I suppose, the amount of innovation that was happening that, as you say, sort of really led us into the modern era of warfare, you know, techniques still used today. Another prevailing myth, I guess, and you touched upon it, you know, we were talking before in the introduction, is that the generals themselves are sort of cold-hearted butchers, yet many of them experienced war at the coalface. You know, they weren't necessarily in remote chateaus or remote headquarters away from the fronts. Some of them were kind of fighting and some of them were injured and killed. And if that wasn't the case, then certainly they had family members who were involved, sometimes even in battles that they themselves directed. So can you give us an example of that?
I mean, the myth of the Chateau General is one of the most enduring myths. And what you see is there's a huge problem in the war, that the war is very big. And the communication technology is not up to what it needs to be, because you do have wireless and radio and things, but they're not really of a scale that to be used. So commanders, you know, have to rely on telephones up to the front line that can be then coordinated. So the information they get, they can't command in a way that Wellington did at Waterloo, where he's on the battlefield and he can see it and he can send liaison officers to the right flank or the left. You can't do that on the Somme. And so generals have to go to places where they can be contacted and where they can then send orders to reserves to where they need to be. And so chateaus become the natural headquarters locations. And against, you know, where else would you expect generals to be? And if a general is in a trench, he can't really influence the battle. So commanders don't like this. Many of the commanders get killed earlier on in the war, particularly because they just go forward, they get frustrated. And this happens repeatedly, where, you know, commanders will be huddled together in a small building somewhere trying to work out what's going on, and they'll get hit by a shell, or things will go wrong. So what happens when things go wrong? Commanders go to the front lines to try and find out. They get killed. We're seeing this today in Ukraine. And you know, if we look at some examples of commanders who are really exposed to it, you know, you've got Haig loses his chief of staff to a sniper. There's three British generals that are killed in 1914 when a shell hits their chateau, killed or seriously wounded. If we look at the French army, many commanders are killed, certainly in the early days. It's less so when you have trench warfare, and then essentially orders are given to those commanders that they have to stay back because there's no point. And as I detail in the book, there are many examples of commanders whose, particularly sons, are killed. Often their sons join up or are junior officers in the war. And junior officer in that war is very, very dangerous. It's probably the most lethal position on the battlefield, leading men into combat. And so Ferdinand Foch loses his only son. Ludendorff loses his only stepson. There's an example of a French general who loses three sons. And so the carnage and the horror of the battle, the generals are not immune from that. They can still make errors. Anyone can. They can still they try their best. But ultimately, the casualties are such that it's very difficult for them to avoid the kind of carnage that's coming to everybody else. And there are leading examples of commanders who find out that their only son has been killed and then sort of just continue working that day. So it can be quite moving. And, you know, again, I think just to providing that sort of human story to those individuals that I think is lacking in many accounts.
Do you think that we'll ever move on from the prevailing myth of the lions led by donkeys? And why does it matter that we do?
I think the cliche is very strong in Britain, and I don't really see that changing. I think it's a sort of shorthand for incompetence and stupidity, and you still see this. Well, if someone does something repetitive and stupid, then someone might describe it as like the generals in the First World War. And I have no problem with that. It's inevitable, and it's very, very difficult to get around it, I think, unless we're talking about the passage of time and it might gradually fade. But I think it's important that we get an accurate view of the war and we can can appreciate that. And I think there's more and more people with more and more knowledge of the war than we've ever had. It's just about a more mature, reasonable assessment of the war, which we can probably make now after 100 years. And I think it just takes time for us, just things to settle down. And so we can begin to look at the First World War with something approaching dispassion to be able to see it, I think, in a better way. So it is important that we move on from it, or at least put it in context that has some truth to it, but it is a myth. And I think the memory of the individuals of the war demands that we have a more accurate assessment of the war that defined the 20th century, whether we like it or not. And so that's why the war is still so important. And having a more accurate assessment of it is crucial, I think. So I think it's important that we look at the First World War, such an event, such a horrific tragedy, in a better way than perhaps than we have done in the past. And I hope my book can make a contribution to that.
So we're going to move on to the part of the podcast where we look at the researcher behind the research and what compels them to explore their area of war studies. So Nick, the Great War has been studied and analysed and interpreted by so many people over so many ages in so many different ways. What made you decide to embark on your research career in this area? Did you feel that you had something new to say about it?
Well, I mean, I'd always been interested in the war from sort of a family connection to the war. So I'd exposed to it at quite a young age.
You had family members who had served?
Yeah, my great uncle was killed in the war. He was 19, I think. And so the loss of him, I mean, again, we only lost one family member, one close family member, really. So a lot of families suffered a lot worse than ours did. But the tragedy of the war was still hung over the family and the memory of him. And so, you know, I was exposed to the war early on and I just found it interesting. I found the war just a compelling period of time. That it all seemed to go back to it. So I wanted to do it. And we didn't do any of it in school. We obviously did the rise of the Nazis, like many people of my generation, where you begin in 1918 or 1919, the end of the war, and you sort of end in 1939. So we never did any war stuff or military history at school. When I went to university, I was keen to actually do it. The more I read about the war, the more I had questions about it. And so you just start doing things. You find little areas that hadn't been studied, and then you do your own research. This book was a continuation of previous research, really, or culmination of a lot of it, really. It's a war that has always fascinated me, and so that's why I've been fortunate to be able to research it at quite a detailed level.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the approach you use, which is very powerful, is to use, as you've talked about, the narrative history rather than academic analysis, which makes for a very enthralling and accessible read. You use very detailed descriptions about place, time, the weather, the scenery, to really draw the reader into the context and situations in which this war was evolving. Why did you choose this approach? And was it a challenge to write in this way if you're more used to kind of abstract theorizing in academic language?
I enjoy writing in the style that I do. I think certainly I've come to a point where I've written a few books on the war. I've plenty of experience in the archives. And I think you just want to sort of widen your lens, I suppose, and provide something that's broader, that can communicate in many cases quite complex ideas, but in a way that it doesn't sort of smack you over the head with it or make it too impenetrable, which can be an issue with some academic writing. I mean, there are pros and cons of all the styles of writing. I simply wanted to write a book that I would have liked to read, really. And I wanted to try and bring it about so that you would read with pleasure and you would read with a sort of interest to see what happens next. I've had people write to me and they say, well, I really enjoyed it. And I nearly got to the end and I still thought the Germans could win. And then they didn't win. And I knew they didn't win, but I still thought they were going to do it at the end, which I think was great. It illustrates the power of just taking time to set the scene and just let their own words come forward. So there are a lot of personal accounts, memoirs, diaries, conversations. And I think it's very important that you bring out their individual words so they can make it live around you in that way. And so that was a choice. I wanted just to write a book that I think people would find interesting and that would try and have a chronological approach that's consistent. You'll have chapters over the winter. Each winter you'll have a chapter or maybe two chapters. So you'll get to see what happens after. So it feels like you have a natural flow of time. So what often you get in books is they'll finish the offensives, writing about the offensives of 1 year, and the following chapter is the spring. With the narrative approach, you get a sense that time is passing in a consistent way, which I think is important just to give yourself a breather before you go into another year. So I find it really enjoyable to write. I don't think it's particularly easy to write that way. I think you have to use imagination. You have to, in some ways, to fill in the blanks where the source material just isn't there. But obviously all tied to the sources as much as you can to provide a read which is coherent, which is academically rigorous, but actually just tells the story and lets the readers make their own mind. That was really a key idea. I just wanted people to just go through it, see who they liked, who they didn't like, and ask themselves the question, what would I have done? Would I have done any better or any differently than those people at the time? And I think most of people come out of it thinking, well, it was pretty hard, wasn't it? It was pretty difficult. I'm not sure I'd have been that bad or that good, or I'd have probably been in the middle like we all would have done. So I think that was a key challenge of the book and something I was really interested to do.
So in your efforts to sort of debunk the myth, have you met with any criticism or backlash from anyone?
Certainly this book has been, you know, I've been very pleased with the reviews and the approach that has been taken, I think. So I haven't really received a backlash. I think there are some people who maybe will never be able to accept that all the generals weren't criminals and that kind of thing. But I think broadly, even if you are a critic of the generals from a relatively informed perspective, you could probably accept a lot of what I'm saying. I mean, people might quibble with this point or that point here or there, but I think broadly there hasn't been too much of a pushback as well, which is obviously encouraging. You never know how people really take it. You can only do what you can do and put it out there to the reader and let people make their own mind up it, and hopefully they like it. I certainly write with the reader in mind. I'm very conscious of the reader as I write, to try and not to overload them with too much information, just to take their hand and let them move through it at their own pace. I mean, in some ways, the Lions Led by Donkeys thing is the main thing people have approached the book with, but it's not the entirety of the story. And I didn't want to come at it from a very radical perspective or all the generals are brilliant. I think I'm quite open at saying, well, look, let's just look at the challenges and the context and the difficulty of doing anything in the First World War without getting everybody killed. Yeah, so no major pushback, which is obviously encouraging. So, you know, let's hope that continues.
Yeah, definitely. And if we do talk about the next two works that you're working on, presumably at the moment, which tell the story of the war on the Eastern Front and then the war in Africa and the Middle East, can you tell us kind of what you're doing with those? Is it the same approach, and what kind of new interpretations are you unearthing?
Yeah, well, at the moment I'm writing the Eastern Front, which will be the second volume, and that will be completed in 2023 for publication in 2024. And then once that's completed, I'll start on the third and final volume. So the Eastern Front is much more, it's been more difficult to write in some ways than the Western Front. Similar challenges. It's written in a similar style from that generalist perspective, from that operational level. And you're taking the reader to places that they're largely unfamiliar with: Serbia, Galicia, Poland, East Prussia, Salonika, the Italian front. So the challenge with the Eastern Front is that there's a lot more different fronts. So you have the main Eastern Front, the Russian Front, and you've got the Balkans theatre as well as Italy. But of course, they were all really concentrated on, you know, if Western Front really is a story of France's war, Eastern Front really the story of Austria-Hungary's war. There are similar challenges. I think there's more difficult challenges with the Eastern Front because of the material and because of the number of different armies that are involved in the Eastern Front: Serbia, Austria-Hungary, Germany, Russia, Italy. It's on a bigger canvas in many ways. But I think it's really the other story. So whereas Western Front, you get glimpses of what's going on the Eastern Front, the mention of an odd battle or something, volume two will take you there to see. And I think certainly what I've found out from the Eastern Front, there is innovation and change and issues that you have on the Western Front, but it's not at the same degree. The Western Front is like a sort of group of elite athletes, France, Britain, Germany, racing against each other, and they bring out the best in each other to a high degree. And the Eastern Front, you don't get the same, because there's innovation, but it's not at the same pace, because I think there's a different dynamic in the East. And the very size of the Eastern Front means that the kind of innovation you see in the West, you're not going to see in the East, because they don't need to, because the fronts are much more fluid. Even there are trench warfare, it's not as concentrated as you get in France. And so it's very different, but it is the other side of the war. And I think similar challenges, but also trying to provide that coherency to the war through all, you know, from 1914 all the way to 18, because some people think the Eastern Front ends in 1917 with the Russian Revolution, but that's not the case.
Yeah, that sounds really fascinating and definitely something we don't know so much about, I guess, in Britain. So I'll definitely look out for that when it comes out. But thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a really fantastic talk, and good luck with writing the next two volumes.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to the War Studies podcast, produced and edited by Lizzie Ellen, Danny McDivitt and Lauren Midgley, from the School of Security Studies at King's College London. For more information on our work and to sign up to receive regular updates, please visit our website, which you'll find in the podcast description. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review us on your preferred podcast provider. It really helps us reach more listeners. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the War Studies Podcast.